Have any of you all been able to listen to the cardiac lecture for this week yet? I know y'all had 402 exam and ATI, so it's fine if you didn't. I just want to know.
I listened to some of it on the way to work.
Okay. What about you, Dallas?
That's actually what I was doing right now. I've only got a little bit into it.
Okay. What about you, Joanna?
Same. I'm kind of still going through it right now.
Okay. Francine, had you had a chance to listen at the cardiac lecture yet? Okay.
I'm gonna be in and out as well because I'm at work.
Okay. All right, so I wanted to do like a case study. I wanted to hit like some keynotes and I wanted to do like a case study. So just to kind of put action into perspective, like so that you can have a better understanding of some of the material. But I'll do like the key points and then we'll kind of work our way through that case study if y'all have. Okay, so with the cardiac lecture this week, so last week Miss Lott went over rhythm strips with you guys. So for this week, we kind of focused on some issues that can happen with the heart, with the structure of the heart. And one of our primary things were how coronary artery disease can lead to patients having a heart attack. So we understand the basics with coronary artery disease. We know that, pretty much if you don't eat right, you don't exercise, your body will start building up with plaque in those vessels, and those that plaque buildup is what actually leads to coronary artery disease that could end up causing a patient to have an MI. So those plaques become unstable as they get bigger and bigger. Just a little bit about the patho of that. We know that certain conditions can lead to that injury forming in those vessels that can lead to that plaque starting to build up. So that's just kind of how the dominoes fall with it. But we know something is major with coronary artery disease. It takes a lot of education. So that's going to be some of the very important things to kind of get into with coronary artery disease patients, knowing, things that they can change and things that they can't change. So that's when you get into your non-modifiable and your modifiable factors. So we know that non-modifiable factors, those are things that what?
You can't change.
You can't change. So if you have a family history of coronary artery disease, mama, daddy, grandma, everybody that's in that first line of relation to you has coronary artery disease, your chances of having it are very high. And then you have your contributing factors. These are things that we know, that can lead to developing coronary artery disease. And then, of course, modifiable. So what are modifiable factors?
So things that we can change.
These are things that we can change. So when you're eating, we look at your lipids. That's why with, coronary artery disease patients, they have hyperlipidemia. So we're looking at your different lipids, your LDLs, HDLs, and which are the good and the bad, which are the good lipoproteins, the LDLs or the HDLs, I mean HDLs.
I guess the HDLs is a good protein, not
Yes. The
LDLs.
HDLs are the good and the LDLs are the bad. So we want patients to have higher HDL levels than LDL because your LDLs are your actual cholesterol levels. And so when those are high, that's bad. Blood pressure. Blood pressure is a major thing that we know can lead to that damage and helping with plaques building up in those vessels. Being diabetic, smoking. Smoking is one of the another major risk factor as well, and then not being in shape. So when you're thinking about those different things, keep in mind the education that you have to do for those. Definitely want to make sure that the patient is eating right when it comes to the lipids, high blood pressure, making sure that it's controlled, making sure that they're likely on something for it, or that they're changing their eating habits. Tobacco use cessation. They need to stop smoking. That's going to be the best education you can give them in regards to that. When it comes to obesity, so coming up with some different exercising methods, something that can benefit them and works well with their schedule, they're going to have to do it. But something that I want you guys to focus on when we're getting into talking about the treatments for coronary artery disease, we know that these patients are going to be starting on a statin drug. And, you know, your statins, those are your cholesterol, your lipid-lowering agents. There are, in your book, there are a lot of drug alerts for those medications. So now that we're talking about cardiac, you know, on the first exam and for exam two, we really didn't talk a lot about different medications, but getting to the cardiac stuff, it's going to be important for you to know your medications and how to educate on those different side effects of them. So, for example, we know that any of the statin drugs, they're crucial on the liver. So we definitely have to make sure that the patient does not have any underlying liver conditions with those. It is a medication in the book. It talks about niacin, and I talk a little bit about it in the lecture as well. It's a water-soluble B vitamin that helps with lowering LDLs. So one of its side effects is that it causes flushing of the skin. In your book, it talks about how if the patient is given aspirin 30 minutes prior to getting niacin, it'll prevent them from flushing. So we're not giving aspirin to like to thin the blood or anything like that. It's being given with niacin to prevent flushing. So just know that that is an alternative for that, because flushing is a side effect of that medication. I also talk a little bit about Gemfibrozil and how patients that are already on warfarin, if they're starting on Gemfibrozil, it actually increases the effects of warfarin. So it places them at a higher risk for bleeding. Okay, so when I start talking in the lecture about the different ECG changes when it comes to unstable angina and the different MIs. So what type of ECG changes will you see with unstable angina? With unstable angina, you're going to see either an ST segment depression or a T-wave inversion. So depression is where it just drops below that isometric line. And then an inversion, the T-wave is supposed to be rounded. It's supposed to be rounded just like the P-wave. But with it being inverted, that means it's pushed downwards below the isometric line. So those are the two significant ECG changes that you would see with unstable angina. And so that lets us know that that heart muscle is experiencing ischemia. So it's not fully into being necrotic and as it will be with an MI, but with angina, unstable angina, that indicates ischemia. So that means decreased oxygen to that tissue. So who can tell me the difference between a non-STEMI, an NSTEMI, and a regular STEMI? What's the difference between the two? They're both a myocardial infarction. They're both a heart attack, but what's the differences between the two?
I know on the EKG it shows the ST is elevated.
The ST is elevated with the STEMI. Versus with the NSTEMI, we don't have ST segment elevation with that one. So which one is there in the occlusive thrombus, meaning there's a clot and it's occluding the vessel? Which one, is it a STEMI or an NSTEMI? That's going to be your STEMI. Your STEMI is going to be the one where it's caused by an occlusive thrombus versus your NSTEMI is caused by a non-occlusive thrombus. Will you see any ECG changes with an NSTEMI?
Not really.
That's right. You may or you may not, but if you do see with an NSTEMI, it could show that ST depression or T wave inversion. But like we said with the STEMI, you're going to see that ST segment elevation. It's no longer going to be depressed. We're going to see elevation with it. So what's our first line of treatment for someone that comes in with a STEMI? Where do they need to go?
The cath lab.
Need to go to the cath lab quick, fast, and in a hurry. What if they're at an outerline facility that is not equipped for cath?
Transfer.
What are we gonna do first before we transfer?
Nitro.
Mm-mm. A thrombolytic.
Let's do the thrombolytic therapy. But we also have some like if they have contraindications, we can't give the clot busters to them. So who can tell me the time frame that thrombolytic therapy must be started?
Oh,
and presenting with those manifestations.
Within 3 hours?
Mm-mm.
Like 90 minutes?
Thrombolytic therapy is a shorter, it's minutes. How many minutes of them presenting with the symptoms? So from the time they were sitting at home on the couch and they started having chest pain to the time they came in. 30 minutes. Thrombolytic therapy must be started within 30 minutes. So we were talking about them needing to go to the cath lab. So yes, how many minutes will they need to be in the cath lab from the time they started presenting with symptoms? It's a little bit more than 30 minutes.
Is that the 90 minutes?
90 minutes. That's the 90 minutes. So to confirm that someone is having a STEMI on the ECG, what are we looking for? We know we're looking for ST segment elevation, but we have to look for it in how many leads? Excuse me. We confirm when it's in at least two neighboring leads, so two leads that are right by each other. So on the EKG, and EKG and ECG, they're the same thing. They just use the words interchangeably. We still refer to the same thing of them doing that 12-lead EKG. The EKG is going to be very significant in helping them to confirm where that blockage is on the heart. Because wherever they see that ST segment elevation, that lets them know that's the part of the heart. So there's a picture in the PowerPoint just kind of showing where certain leads show where different areas in those coronary arteries are. That's why EKGs are very important. That way they won't have to spend too much time. They know once they take them to the cath lab, they'll know where they need to go. So let's talk about the treatment. So we know the first line is that they need to go to the cath lab, right? We talked about the thrombolytic therapy and how it needs to be started within 30 minutes. With the thrombolytic therapy, we know that that's a clot buster, right? So what is it going to do to the blood? What does it do to the blood? It's a clot buster.
Is it gonna thin the blood?
It's gonna thin it. That clot buster is gonna thin the blood. So you as the nurse, we've given the clot buster. This patient, we need to be monitored for signs of what?
Bleeding.
Bleeding. Yes. So knowing the difference between minor versus major. So who can give me an example of some a minor bleed? A minor bleed is like where they start oozing from around the IV site. That's something we can fix, right? We can apply some pressure. If they start bleeding around the gums, that's considered minor bleeding. So those are things that we can, that's expected and that we can control. That's not something you're gonna call the doctor about. But who can give me some signs of major bleeding?
GI.
Dip seeing blood in the stool, yeah. What else?
Guess vomiting blood. Would that
Yeah,
be?
if they're vomiting blood. What about vital signs? What vital signs will be affected?
Blood pressure.
The pulse.
The heart rate's gonna be what? Elevated or decreased?
Elevated.
Elevated, and blood pressure is gonna be
Down.
Decrease.
decrease. What about a change in their mental status? Is that a sign of major bleeding?
Yes, because they're not getting that oxygen.
Or they're bleeding on the brain.
Oh, yeah.
So those are your signs of minor versus major. So if the patient is hooked to thrombolytic therapy and they start showing those signs of major bleeding, what are you gonna do?
Stop it.
Stop it and do what?
Call the provider.
Stop the medication and call the provider. So now let's talk about some of the medications. What's our number one medication for chest pain?
Nitro.
Nitroglycerin. And 9 times out of 10, en route, that patient's gonna be getting sublingual nitro, right? So once the patient come in, they've maxed out of the amount they could take sublingual for nitro. What's your next choice? Now, what can we do?
Does it start with an L?
Mm-mm.
Oh, well, that's not what I'm thinking of.
Would you give them a beta blocker?
Not quite just yet. We're still focusing on the chest pain. You've maxed out of all the sublingual that they can take. Now, what can we start them on?
IV.
IV nitroglycerin. And see, with IV nitroglycerin, you can titrate according to chest pain. So if they're still having chest pain, you can continue to go up and go up and go up. So, what's the side effect that we need to look out for with nitroglycerin? There's a couple.
Headache.
Headache. What can it do to the blood pressure?
Drop it.
Drop it. And that's why we want to be hesitant first before we do anything with beta blockers because we know nitroglycerin can drop the blood pressure. It also causes flushing too. Okay, so we're getting close to being maxed out on IV nitroglycerin and they're still having chest pain. Now what can we give?
The beta blocker now.
Mm-mm.
No.
It's something that we give for pain, but in this instance, we're giving it to help the heart. Starts with an M.
Morphine.
Morphine. We're giving it, yes, we know it's going to help with the pain, but we're giving it because it decreases how hard the heart has to work because morphine works as a vasodilator. So it helps open up those vessels and decrease the heart from working as hard. So you're not giving it for pain. You're giving it to decrease the cardiac workload on the heart. But we're giving morphine, we know that it does what? So we need to watch out for what with morphine.
It can cause respiratory depression.
Yes. Watch out for respiratory depression, and it can also affect the blood pressure and heart rate, right? Mm-hmm. All right. So beta blockers will only be in the instance where the patient's heart rate and blood pressure is fine. So definitely don't pick and say we're going to give a beta blocker if your patient's heart rate is below 60 and the blood pressure is in the dirt, because we're going to kill them if we give a beta blocker. Who can tell me why the patient would be starting on an ACE inhibitor or an ARB? What are we giving that for? Now, this after they've had, like, after they've gotten stabilized after the heart cath, why do they start them on an ACE or an ARB?
Because if their blood pressure not high, it wouldn't be for that. So is it for heart failure?
Yes, that's right. Oh. That's right. Vents are slow them from progressing into heart failure. And it also helps with ventricular remodeling, because if you got to dig back in your path up for this, but y'all know whenever the heart, that left ventricle works so hard, the muscle of it starts to hypertrophy. And we worry about ventricular remodeling. So that's why we start them on that, to prevent that from happening. And as far as lipid drugs, they're going to be placed, if they weren't on a lipid drug, they're going to be placed on one that day, because we know that that's what ended up leading to them having a heart attack anyway. Why is it important for patients to be on stool softeners as well?
So they don't strain.
You don't want them straining on the toilet and just had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So, right. We don't want them putting any more stress on their body. Definitely not for no poop. Okay. So I talked about the inflammatory disorders as well. So infective endocarditis, what do we know that's going on with it?
Inflammation.
Inflammation of what layer of the heart?
The myo.
The name of it is infective endocarditis. The endocardium. That's your innermost layer of the heart. That's the heart layer that make up those heart valves as well. So if you've ever taken care of a patient with that, pretty much what happens is this patient has bacteria that has been introduced into their bloodstream. That bacteria is going to travel to the heart and implant itself on those heart valves. It's going to cause, after it implants itself on the heart valves, the body forms an inflammatory response where all those mediators go to that area, and that bacteria is going to build up and produce what's called vegetation. So this patient's valves have vegetation on it, and that vegetation can break off and it can float around. And that vegetation can actually, it's a risk factor because it can go to the brain. Once it floats and it's flicked off, is considered emboli at that point. So it can go to the brain, it can go to different parts of the body and decrease blood flow. So it's not good at all. So now that we know how that situation happens, which patients are at high risk for this? If they've had what recently?
Strep?
Not necessarily strep. But if they've had what recently? Any invasive procedures, dental procedures, if they've had a baby, any recent surgery. So anything that's invasive that, you know, can pre-expose you to any type of bacteria. But it's most commonly with dental procedures. Do y'all watch Grey's Anatomy?
I used to, a long time ago.
The recent episodes, it was this past season, one of the physicians, she had a really bad tooth in her mouth, and she didn't go and get it seen about, and she was in the OR doing surgery, and she ended up collapsing, and they coded her, and come to find out she had ineffective endocarditis because that bacteria from her tooth got into her bloodstream, went to her heart, and caused that condition.
Mm.
We definitely see it a lot. Whenever I worked in the hospital, I used to get a lot of IV drug users. They use dirty needles that ended up with the condition, and that's a major risk factor as well because they don't clean their needles. But yeah, those little clots, they'll break off and they'll go to certain areas in the body. And one time I ended up with a patient, actually, he was an IV drug user and the emboli flicked off. A lot of it went to his brain. So when they scanned his brain, that's all they saw was the scattered emboli on both lobes, in both lobes. So that's what they call septic emboli. He was septic from it as well. So when you think about talking to a patient, and that patient has to get IV antibiotics for weeks. So in the hospital with our IV drug users, because they gonna put like a PICC line in for them to get their antibiotics, those patients actually have to stay in the hospital their entire time because you can't discharge a drug user home with the PICC line. Like, you send them up for failure. But for someone that's not a drug user, they send them home with the PICC line. Home health come out there and do their antibiotics. So let's think about some things that we can educate on with patient teaching in regards to that. Like, what can you educate your patient on with going home with a PICC line and with antibiotics? What's some things we can talk about with them?
Signs of yeast infection.
And usually with the yeast, they'll just put them on something, you know, antifungal for that, but that can be a risk factor. But what about worsening signs of infection, like especially for the line, if they got redness at the site, if they develop drainage at the site, or if they start feeling sick, running fever. Fever is going to be major though. If they start having fever out of nowhere, they need to call the physician because the antibiotics clearly aren't working.
So the first sign is going to be the redness and swelling is what?
Fever, really. Fever. Okay. Okay. Fever will let them know that the endocarditis, that medication is not helping with it. But I'm saying, like, you know, they need to take care of their line, you know, with sterile dressing changes, things like that. So something that we see with ineffective endocarditis, and y'all gonna see on the picture in that lecture, where those little clots, they'll go off to the extremities and cause like those little red spots all over their body in different areas. So those are the vascular signs of that condition. So with pericarditis, so this is inflammation of which layer?
Pericardium.
And that's the area where we got the fluid, right? The fluid prevents friction whenever the heart is beating. So if that area gets inflamed, that fluid can build up in that pericardium. So that's a risk factor that we'll talk about. But how does the patient present with pericarditis?
They have some shortness of breath.
They are going to have shortness of breath. And their chest pain is going to be worse whenever they take a breath in and whenever they're laying flat. So who can tell me the position that relieves their pain?
Would it be when they're leaning over?
Yes, that's correct. So when they're leaning forward in like their tripod position, that gives them relief for that chest pain. So you as the nurse, there's gonna be a hallmark finding for that condition. It's called the pericardial friction rub. And you're gonna hear like a very sharp grating sound. Where can you listen at that sound at? Where is it best heard at? Where on the chest?
Is it
behind
the ear?
The lower left sternal border of the chest with the patient leaning forward. That's how you'll be able to listen at that grating sound. How can we tell the difference if it's a pleural or a pericardial rub? What do we tell the patient to do while we're listening?
Would you tell them to hold their breath?
Yes.
I was trying to remember because I know we heard this before.
Yeah, you tell them to hold their breath. And if you still hear it while they're holding their breath, that lets you know it's pericardial versus pleural. So what's the complication of acute pericarditis? Starts with the C. We already talked about how this is where that fluid will start to build up in that pericardial sac. So what's a complication? It's called a cardiac tamponade. So the cardiac tamponade is the fluid is continuing to build up in the pericardial area. And what do you think it's going to do with that fluid building up around the heart? What is it going to do? It works very similar to how a tissue pneumothorax works. So what does it do?
That fluid builds up and they shortness of breath and pain.
No, what is it doing to the heart and the lungs? If you got fluid build up around your heart and it's just accumulating and accumulating, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's going to start pushing because it's squeezing the heart, it's compressing it. So it's squeezing the heart can't beat effectively. And it's also moving in the chest, which is causing pressure on the lungs. So the same way with the tension pneumothorax.
That's an emergency.
Yes, that is a major emergency. Who knows what the classic features of that is? How is the patient going to present with a cardiac tamponade? What are we going to see? It's three things. We call it Beck's triad.
Bradycardia.
I think you're thinking about Cushing's triad. It's gonna be muffled heart sounds, JVD, which is jugular vein distension, and pulsus paradoxus. And pulsus paradoxus is where there's a large decrease in the systolic blood pressure when they breathe in. So all three of those signs lets us know cardiac tamponade is happening.
Okay.
So, usually for pericarditis, your treatment is mainly going to be NSAIDs. That's going to help with pain and inflammation. There's another medication that we use for pericarditis. It's used for gout. You can tell me what it is.
Is one start with a C?
Colchicine.
Colchicine, yeah.
We give that to pericarditis patients to help with, like, because usually if they get it one time, they'll get it again. So colchicine prevents them from having recurrent pericarditis.
I can't see it. That's why I just say C.
Colchicine. And then our last inflammatory condition was myocarditis. And so that's inflammation of what layer of the heart?
Myocardium.
The myocardium, the muscle. And we know the muscle is very important because that's where your impulses are originated from. So if that layer is inflamed, then we can definitely expect to see some ECG changes, some difficulty with the conduction system in the heart. And these patients, ultimately, they just present like heart failure patients with myocarditis. So. Okay. Y'all want to try to work on a little case study?
I was just going to tell you, I got a patient, so I got to zoom back out again.
Okay. Somebody wrote me in the chat. Okay, I see you answering, Francine. Your mic don't work on that computer at this time. Let's see. For those of you who do, your mic do work, then let's work on this little case study together. And you don't have to, I'm not expecting you to know, you know, everything. It's just to kind of help you with applying what we've kind of talked about. So I'm gonna minimize y'all and then I'm gonna share my screen. Can y'all see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so we're gonna do this little case study. And it's focusing on coronary artery disease and acute coronary syndrome. So at the top, it just kind of gives you an overview of each of those conditions, pretty much what we kind of talked about. So the case study down here at the bottom, if you have a piece of paper, you can jot down some of this information about the patient. If not, just kind of keep note of it. Let's see. I had a chat. Let me see what's being said in the chat. Let me pause that. So I'm going to open this up so I can see what was said in the chat. Hold on. Of the EKG strip. Oh, Sharika, that was Ms. Lot content. So I can tell you though, pretty much when you're counting the rates on the EKG strip, various complexes. So the big tips at the top of those, so the QRS, you'll count those and multiply it by 10. That's how you'll get your heart rate. So let me start back sharing the screen. So let me minimize that. We got Gigi, which is a 62-year-old white male with a 15-year history of coronary artery disease and hypertension. He had an anterior lateral MI 2 years ago. He also has a history of hyperlipidemia, type 2 diabetes, chronic renal insufficiency. His father died of cardiac death at age 44. His mother died while undergoing a CABG at 68. His hypertension is treated with HCTZ and verapamil. He takes metformin for his diabetes and atorvastatin for his high cholesterol. He is a current cigarette smoker with a 45-pack year smoking history, drinks a beer almost daily. He's 5'10", weighs 209 pounds, and does not regularly exercise. He tries to watch what he eats, but he travels a lot as a computer consultant and is difficult to maintain a healthy diabetic diet when he's out of town. So just by the case study, what are some things that stood out to y'all?
Well, it seems like they have a family history of heart failure. Since mm-hmm. mom and dad both had heart issues. He is a smoker.
Definitely a smoker. He had a heart attack 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's got everything, all the contributing factors, hyperlipidemia, type 2 diabetes, chronic renal insufficiency, the 45-pack year smoking history. He's a computer consultant, so that means he probably sits down majority of his day at work. He says it's hard to maintain a diabetic diet, so that lets us know he doesn't eat right. Drinks a beer almost daily. So he's got a lot of things that are playing into him being, you know, at risk for what he does. Can y'all hear that? I may have to share my, were y'all able to hear that playing? The little video? I'm gonna include my computer sound.
Stone, what brings you to the emergency department today?
Can y'all hear that before I finish cleaning it?
Yes, ma'am.
I seem to have some pressure in my chest that won't go away with the nitroglycerin my doctor told me to take.
He awoke 2 nights ago with pain in the middle of his chest. He was also quite nauseated. He took the nitroglycerin as prescribed, and it took 2 tablets to decrease the pain and about 6 hours for the pain to go away altogether. He was okay after that until early this morning when he woke up with the same pain. He took 2 more nitroglycerins, but the pain is just not going away. So I thought I better bring him in.
I'm glad you did. Let's get you back to a room and see what's going on.
While the nursing assistant helps the patient change into a patient gown and transfer onto the stretcher, you pull up Mr. Gladstone's health history on...
So I'm going to pause it because all it, the little thing going to do is just read to y'all what it's supposed to hear. So we got 62-year-old white male, 15-year history, pretty much everything that we read already in the case study. So let's look at this one. Indicate whether the risk factor is modifiable and non-modifiable. So we just talked about those. So hypertension, is this a modifiable or non-modifiable? And don't be afraid to answer.
Okay, so I feel like with the hypertension, maybe it can be a bit confusing because I feel like you can modify it by certain lifestyle changes in your diet. But then what about if you have a family that has a history of hypertension? I guess with that, it increases your risk, but I guess it would be modifiable. I don't know.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Even though hypertension, you can control your hypertension. That's something that can be controlled. So when you think about the difference between modifiable and non-modifiable, these are things, modifiable are things that you can control. I'm gonna use myself a prime example. My mom has terrible hypertension and now I have blood pressure issues. I'm now on medication, I eat differently and I take my medication. And every time I go to the doctor, guess what? My pressure is either 120 over 80 or between the 90s, my systolic is in the 90s and my diastolic is in the 80s. So, I mean, that's an example. Cigarette smoking. Modifiable or non-modifiable?
Modifiable.
Definitely modifiable. Physical inactivity.
Modifiable.
Obesity.
Modifiable.
Diabetes. If you eat right, you can, your
you can A1C change it, yeah.
Yeah, your A1C can be low enough to where you're stable. Gender male. Can he change the fact that he's a male?
No.
No. Genetics.
No.
Can't change that. Mom and daddy had it, so he was gonna end up with it anyway. Age?
No.
All right.
You now perform a quick, focused assessment.
Mr. Gladstone, can you describe your pain for me?
Well, it's different from my usual angina pain. That pain has never woke me up in the middle of the night. It usually only occurred when I would walk or do something strenuous. This pain just woke me up. It almost felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest. It also feels like someone is trying to stab me from my stomach clear to my back. And the nitroglycerin, it's just not taking the pain away as quickly or as fully as it usually does.
On a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the worst pain and 0 being no pain, how would you rate your pain right now?
Well, it was a 10 when I initially woke up. I'd say it's about a 4 or 5 right now.
Are you having any other symptoms?
I'm a little sick to my stomach, and I sometimes feel that I can't catch my breath.
All right, so based off the assessment findings, so let's talk through what he said. He said it's different from his chronic stable angina, which with chronic stable, they know it's usually, it comes about when they overexert themselves, right? Versus this pain, what did he say about this pain? This pain is different. What did he describe his pain as being?
I just say like the elephant sitting on his chest and feel like someone is stabbing him, like a stabbing pain as well.
And he said it didn't go away.
It didn't go away.
Significantly different from, you know, his usual chest pain that goes away. So based off of his assessment findings, he's most likely experiencing what? We already scratched out chronic stable because he said it was different. Chronic stable, that pain stops. This pain does not stop. So is it cholecystitis, peptic ulcer, or acute coronary syndrome?
That's the acute coronary syndrome.
Yes.
The emergency department physician has seen Mr. Gladstone and written orders based on evidence-based practice for patients with acute coronary syndrome.
Mr. Gladstone, we are going to run some tests and give you some medication to help your chest pain. First, I'm going to give you some oxygen and have you chew some aspirin. I'll hook you up to a cardiac monitor and then start an IV. I'll also be giving you some sublingual nitroglycerin to ease your chest pain.
So, based on Gigi's clinical manifestations and health history, which diagnostic test would best confirm or rule out myocardial damage? And so we got three correct answers. So we're looking at which labs are going to be related to show us that his myocardium has gotten damaged from this ACS. So which tests are we going to do?
Echocardiogram.
Will it necessarily show you? Well, it could. It could show the it could show the activity of the muscle, but which ones we know for a fact? And it's gonna be lab values.
But your troponins for sure.
Both the troponins and what else?
Is it the CKMB?
The CKMB. Those are your three. Because we know whenever with the MI, the muscle is going to release. It's going to release into the bloodstream, and those lab values indicate that muscle damage is present. Troponin and CKMB. So that's going to, you know, give us a quick diagnostic versus the echo. The echo is just kind of touch here and there. It may or may not show. But those are definitely going to. I'm gonna skip this one because it's a little bit, it's just asking about the norms of those, and we don't have the norms listed, so we're not.
Mr. Gladstone, I need to do an ECG, a cardiogram, on you to check your heart. I'm going to be putting these patches on your chest.
Sure thing. Do whatever you need to do.
So she's going to be putting a 5-lead monitor on. So this is usually our one that we put on the patients on the floor. So y'all remember, they have a saying, white on right, smoke over fire. But we know that those leads kind of lead up to looking at different areas. So we've got our right arm here. Left arm, which one is the one in the middle?
One.
That's going to be your V1. That's the usually the brown one. Okay. So you examine the ECG recording for indication of myocardial ischemia. So what did I tell y'all myocardial ischemia is going to look like on the EKG? What are we going to see? Depression or elevation?
Elevation.
Elevation is going to show us what? An actual infarction. It's going to be depression. Depression. So remember, depression is going to show you ischemia. Elevation is going to show you infarction.
Okay.
Infarction is actual dead tissue. Versus ischemia lets you know the tissue is not getting enough oxygen. That's the difference between the two.
After 3 nitroglycerin tablets, Mr. Gladstone's pain is unchanged, and a nitroglycerin infusion is ordered and titrated to control pain and maintain the systolic blood pressure greater than 90 millimeters mercury.
Mr. Gladstone, we are starting your nitroglycerin infusion. On a scale of 0 to 10, how would you rate your chest pain now?
It hasn't changed much yet. I'd rate it about a 4.
So, this is a dosage problem. I'm going to work it out on my phone. And if y'all got paper, you can maybe work it out quicker than me, but let's work this problem out. So we're looking for meals per hour. So what we have, we've increased 20 mics per minute, and you accurately calculate the increased infusion rate for 100 milligrams and 500 meals. So we're trying to get meals per hour. So we go from 20 mics per minute, we need to convert to mics per hour, and then we'll go from mics per hour to mics per milligrams per hour, and then from there. So we're going to do 20 mics over a minute, and then we're going to put 60 minutes over an hour. So 20 times 60, that gives you 1,200. So we got 1,200 mics per hour. And then we need to do mics per hour. I wish I had some paper. Mics per hour times the milligrams and micrograms. So we got 1 milligram over 1,000 micrograms. So 1,200 divided by 1,000. And that's going to give us 1.2. So we got 1.2 milligrams per hour. So now we can move from milligrams per hour to meals per hour, because we already have 100 milligrams over 500. So we're going to do, we got 1.2 milligrams per hour, and then we got the 100 milligrams. So we're going to put 1.2 times 500, because you put your 500 meals over the 100 milligrams, cancel out your milligrams. 1.2 gives you 600. Divided by 100. So I got 6. Did anybody else work it out?
6.
Got 6. All right, so for which side effects of nitroglycerin are we going to monitor for? We just talked about it.
Headache.
Definitely headache.
Hypotension.
Hypotension. What else?
Dizziness. Oh, flushing. Was it dizziness? Yep.
That's right. Those are your side effects of nitroglycerin. So his pain is still not relieved by nitroglycerin. So what do you think the physician is going to prescribe now?
Morphine.
Morphine. We just talked about it. Yep, that's correct.
When I had a heart attack a few years ago, the doctor ordered clot-busting drugs that helped to prevent damage to my heart. Can I get that same treatment again?
So, he wants to know, can he get the thrombolytic therapy? In his instance, with his current situation, what are we going to prioritize over the thrombolytic therapy? Because like 9 times out of 10, he's at a facility that can accommodate cath lab. So what's the correct answer choice for this? We know it's not C.
Would it be the kidney function being impaired?
His kidney function, I wouldn't necessarily say putting him at greater risk for hemorrhage. But what did he say our first line of treatment is versus?
Oh, it would be the last one.
Oh yeah,
let's do PCI. We will only do that if the PCI wasn't readily available, but it don't tell you in this case it's readily available, but we're going to assume that it was readily available.
Mr. Gladstone's EC.
I'm going to pause there. These are pretty much the doctor's orders that he put in. That's all they're doing is just reading.
Mr. Gladstone, I'm going to start 2 IV infusions, one with heparin and the other with a drug called Integrilin. These are common medications that are given to patients with heart disease who are having chest pain to prevent new or additional blood clots from forming in the arteries of your heart. We'll keep a close eye on your blood work in order to give you just the right dose.
Oh, that's another dosage. And we done ran out of time. Okay. Y'all did good. I feel like we hit some good high points on the cardiac material. So I'm gonna do lunch for those of you that got on late for Friday. Instead of doing 4 to 5, I'm gonna do the lunch time 12 to 1 because we got white coat ceremony Friday. So I'll focus on Integrin on Friday. But does anybody have any questions before we hop off?
Any tips on how to study for the heart? Because it's my hardest subject.
I mean, you seem like you got it.
I surprised myself that I remembered that stuff. So I'm like, wait, I know something.
Pretty much for this content that we just covered, knowing the high points, knowing your education, knowing the do's and don'ts, especially for all that stuff, but we hit some good key points. So your this virtual office hour is recorded if you need to go back and listen at it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Montgomery, would you all be able to post maybe like 1 or 2 like sample questions just to kind of get a gauge on, you know, while we're studying and preparing, maybe in the discussion or something?
Sample questions like what?
Pertaining to the topic material.
I mean, we give you we do the ATI, the custom questions over there.
Okay, I'll look at that.
Yeah, those are, now they're not exactly like the exam questions, but those are good ways to, they give you some application style questions in there.
Okay, so I didn't look to see. So you have something posted now?
No, I'm gonna go ahead and post it in a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
Announcement, letting y'all know when those are posted.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm gonna go ahead and hop off here, and I'll get those ATI questions posted. And for those of you, if you haven't, make sure you upload your school report so that you can get your grade if you didn't get your grade last night. All right. Well, y'all have a good rest of your day.
You too. Thanks.
All righty.